This is Audible.
Recorded Books Incorporated presents an unabridged recording of I Am the Cheese by Robert Cormier, narrated by Jeff Woodman, with the role of Brint portrayed by John Randolph Jones. This work, copyrighted 1977 by Robert Cormier, is recorded by arrangement with Curtis Brown Limited. This recording is copyrighted 1993 by Recorded Books Incorporated. A boy's search for his father is about to become a desperate journey into a secret past. But it is a past that must not be remembered if he is to survive. And now, I Am the Cheese.
I am riding the bicycle, and I am on Route 31 in Monument, Massachusetts, on my way to Rutherburg, Vermont, and I'm pedaling furiously, because this is an old-fashioned bike. No speeds, no fenders, only the warped tires and the brakes that don't always work, and the handlebars with the cracked rubber grips to steer with. A plain bike, the kind my father rode as a kid years ago. It's cold as I pedal along, the wind like a snake slithering up my sleeves and into my jacket and my pants legs, too. But I keep pedaling. I keep pedaling. This is Mechanic Street in Monument, and to my right, high above on a hill, there's a hospital, and I glance up at the place, and I think of my father in Rutherburg, Vermont, and my pedaling accelerates. It's 10 o'clock in the morning, and it is October. Not a Thomas Wolfe October of burning leaves and ghost winds, but a rotten October. Dreary, cold, and damp, with little sun, and no warmth at all. Nobody reads Thomas Wolfe anymore, I guess, except my father and me. I did a book report on The Web and the Rock, and Mr. Parker in English 2 regarded me with suspicion and gave me a B- instead of the usual A. But Mr. Parker and the school and all of that are behind me now, and I pedal. Your legs do all the work on an old bike like this, but my legs feel good, strong, with staying power. I pass by a house with a white picket fence, and I spot a little kid who's standing on the sidewalk, and he watches me go by, and I wave to him because he looks lonesome, and he waves back. I look over my shoulder, but there's no one following. At home, I didn't wave goodbye to anybody. I just left, without fanfare. I didn't go to school. I didn't call anyone. I thought of Amy, but I didn't call her. I woke up this morning and saw an edge of frost framing the window, and I thought of my father, and I thought of the cabinet downstairs in the den, and I lay there, barely breathing, and then I got up and knew where I was going. But I stalled. I delayed. I didn't leave for 2 hours because I'm a coward, really. I'm afraid of 1,000 things, 1,000,000. Like, is it possible to be claustrophobic and yet fear open spaces too? I mean, elevators panic me. I stand in the upright coffin and my body oozes sweat and my heart pounds. And this terrible feeling of suffocation threatens me, and I wonder if the doors will ever open. But the next day, I was playing center field. I hate baseball, but the school insists on one participating sport. Anyway, I stood there, with all that immensity of space around me in center field, and I felt as though I'd be swept off the face of the planet, into space. I had to fight a desire to fling myself on the ground and cling to the earth. And then there are dogs. I sat there in the house, thinking of all the dogs that would attack me on the way to Rutherburg, Vermont, and I told myself, this is crazy. I'm not going. But at the same time, I knew I would go. I knew I would go the way you know a stone will drop to the ground if you release it from your hand. I went to the cabinet in the den and took out the gift from my father. I wrapped it in aluminum foil and then wrapped it again with newspaper, scotch taping it all securely. Then I went down to the cellar, and I got the pants and shoes and jacket, but it took me at least a half hour to find the cap. But I found it. The cap I needed. My father's old cap. It would be cold on the road to Vermont, and This cap is perfect. Woolen. The kind that I could pull over my ears if the cold became a problem. Then I raided my savings. I have plenty of money. I have $35.93. I have enough money to travel first class to Vermont in the Greyhound bus that goes all the way to Montreal, but I know that I am going by bike to Rutherburg, Vermont. I don't want to be confined to a bus. I want the open road before me. I want to sail on the wind. The bike was waiting in the garage, and that's how I wanted to go. By bike. By my own strength and power. For my father. I looked at myself in the mirror before I left, the full-length mirror on the side of the closet door in my parents' bedroom upstairs. I inspected myself in the mirror, the crazy hat and the old jacket, and I knew that I looked ridiculous. But what the hell, as Amy says philosophically. I thought longingly of Amy. But she was at school and almost impossible to call. I could have faked it. I could have called the school and pretended that I was her father and asked to speak to her, saying that there was an emergency at home. Her father is editor of the Monument Times and always speaks with emergency in his voice, his sentences like headlines. But I have to be in the mood to pull off a stunt like that. In fact, those kind of stunts are Amy's specialty. And besides, my mind was on the road to Vermont. I love Amy Hertz. It's ridiculous that her name is Hertz. She's probably heard 1,000 car rental jokes, and I have vowed never to make one. Anyway, I decided not to call her. Not until I'm away. I will call her on the way to Rutherburg, Vermont. And I will soothe myself by thinking of her and her numbers and all the times she let me kiss her and hold her. But I didn't want to think about all that as I prepared for my journey. I went to the kitchen and took out the bottle of pills from the cabinet and decided not to take one. I wanted to do this raw, without crutches, without aid, alone. I opened the bottle of pills and turned it over and let the pills fall out. They are capsules, actually, green and black. And I watched them disappear into the mouth of the garbage disposal. I felt strong and resolute. I got the bike out of the garage and walked down the driveway, guiding the bike before I swung into the seat. I had my father's package in the basket above the front wheel. I was traveling light, with no provisions or extra clothing. Finally, I leaped onto the bike, feeling reckless and courageous. At that moment, the sun came out, dazzling and brilliant, an omen of good fortune. I swung out into the street, and a car howled its horn at me for straying too far into the roadway, and I wavered on the bicycle, the front wheel wobbling. I thought, this is ridiculous, this trip to Rutherburg. I almost turned back, but I didn't. I thought of my father, and I started pedaling away, and I gained momentum and knew I would go. Nothing would stop me. Nothing. And now I am leaving Monument and crossing the town line into Aswell. A sign by the side of the road says that the Aswell Rotary Club meets every Monday at noon. I have only gone 4 or 5 miles and my legs don't feel strong anymore. My legs are weary and my back sings with pain because I'm out of condition. Frankly, I have never been in condition, which is a source of delight to Amy Hertz, who dislikes all kinds of physical exercise. I keep pedaling despite the weariness and the pain. I am determined to go to Rutherburg. I suck in the cold air and it caresses my lungs. My forehead is damp with sweat, and I pull the cap down over my ears. I have all those miles to go. Take it easy, I tell myself. Take it easy, 1 mile at a time. And suddenly, there's a long hill slanting down before me, and the bike picks up speed, and my legs are whirling madly, without effort, the bike carried by the momentum, and I let myself join the wind, soaring over the road as I coast beautifully down into Aswell.
Tape OZK-001-0930. Date deleted. TA. Good morning. My name is Brent. We shall be spending some time together. 5-second interval.
Good morning.
Shall we begin immediately? I've been advised that you're ready. The sooner we begin, the better it will be for you.
I'm not sure where to begin.
First, you must relax. And then let your thoughts flow. Take your time. There's no cause for hurry. Go back, if you wish. Back to your earliest remembrance. 8-second interval.
It's hazy. Just a series of impressions.
Let the impressions come. 5-second interval.
That night.
Tell me about that night.
It's as if I was born that night. I mean, became a person, a human being in my own right. Before that, nothing. Or those impressions again. Lights, smell, perfume. The perfume my mother always wore, lilac. Nothing else. And then that night.
12-second interval. Tell me about it.
He was in bed, and the sheets were twisted around him, and his body was hot, his eyes like raw onions, head aching. He cried out once or twice, softly, tentatively. He lifted his head toward the door. The door was partially open, allowing a slant of feeble light into the room. He curled up in bed, listening. He always liked to listen at night. Often he heard his mother and father murmuring in their bedroom, the bed making a lot of noise. And there were the nice sounds of his father and mother together, making soft sounds as if they were furry animals, like the stuffed animals he always slept with, Bitty the bear and Pokey the pig, his friends. His father would say, "Hey, boy, you're getting too old for all those toys, 3 1/2 going on 4. The boy knew that his father was joking, that he would never take his friends away. Anyway, his mother would say, Now, he's a long time from 4, a long, long time. The tenderness in her voice, and her perfume, like lilac in the spring. Now the boy cuddled in the bed with Pokey the pig, his favorite, clutched to his chest. But something kept him awake, prevented him from sleeping. Out of the half-dark of the house, he realized that his mother's and father's voices were different. Not soft and murmuring the way they usually were at night, but louder. Not really louder, but harsher. They were speaking in whispers, but their voices scratched at the night and the dark. And he heard his mother say, "Shh, you might wake him." The boy lay still, as unmoving as Pokey the pig. The bed creaked in the next room, and he heard his father's bare feet padding toward his room. His figure blocked out the slant of light. Then his father's footsteps receded, the light spilled into the room again, and the boy felt brave and clever, knowing he had fooled his father. He wanted to tell Pokey how clever he was, but he remained still and silent, not daring to move, listening not only with his ears, but his entire being.
What did you hear?
I'm not sure. What I mean is, I don't know whether I actually heard the words or if I'm filling them in now, like blank spaces on a piece of paper you have to complete. I was barely 3 1/2, I guess. Anyway, I knew they were discussing me. More than that. As if they were discussing what to do about me. And I got all panicky and began to cry, but quiet crying so they wouldn't hear me.
5-second interval. Why this panic?
Well, it's as if they were deciding my fate. I thought they were going to send me away. I heard my mother say, "But what do we tell him?" And my father saying, "It doesn't matter. He's too young to realize what's happening." Did I really hear him saying that, or did the sense of what he was saying come to me? Then they began talking about a trip, the three of us, and I felt better. It was winter outside, snow and cold, and I didn't want to leave the house where it was nice and warm. But as long as we were together, I really didn't care.
Do you remember the trip?
Vaguely again. I remember a journey. Endless. On a bus. The terrible smell of the exhaust. The doors hissed like a snake when they opened. Impressions. Crowded with luggage. Faces. My father's cigarettes. Not the smell of smoke, really, but the smell of his matches. The sulfur of the matches. Strange.
6-second interval. What's strange?
I was always aware of two smells. My mother's perfume, and the way my father always smelled of tobacco or smoke or the matches. But after that night, after the bus trip, I don't associate my father with cigarettes anymore. Because my father doesn't smoke. I've never seen him smoke a cigarette. But my mother's perfume was the same.
Do you remember anything else about the trip?
Not specifically. Mostly the mood, the feeling of the trip, as if...
As if what?
It was spooky, scary, but not in a haunted house sort of way. But as if we were being chased, as if we were running away. I remember my mother's face as she looked out the window. She looked so sad, purple half-moons under her eyes. So sad. And the bus speeding through the night.
15-second interval. Anything else?
We never went back. Not back to what I thought was home. We were in a different home, a different house, a different aura to the house. It was still winter and cold, and we were together, my mother and father and me. But everything was different.
What it appears to be is this. Your family moved from one part of the country to another, but not too far. It was still winter where you went and winter where you came from. A lot of families move. Men are transferred in their jobs. Your father could have been transferred as well.
Maybe.
Why are you hesitating? You appear uncertain.
I am.
About what?
I don't know.
But he did know. He didn't want to confide the knowledge to the doctor, however. The doctor was a complete stranger, and although he seemed sympathetic and friendly, he wasn't entirely comfortable with him. It should have been easy to tell him everything, all his doubts, to get it all off his chest, but he wasn't sure how to proceed. He wondered if he should tell him about the clues.
What clues?
What do you mean, clues?
What you just said. You used the word clues.
He retreated into silence, stunned. Could the doctor read his mind? Impossible. Or maybe the medicine was doing funny things again. The medicine was always playing tricks on him. And now it was making him believe he was only thinking when he was actually speaking aloud. He would have to be careful. He would have to watch himself, to listen for his voice. The panic shivered in his bones, and a terrible tingling took possession of his body.
I'd like to go back now.
Of course.
I'm tired.
I understand. Don't press. There's plenty of time.
Thank you.
Everything's going to be all right. End tape OZK-001.
Aswell, Fairfield, Carver.
The man calls out the names like the train announcer at North Station in Boston.
Fleming, Hooksett, Belton Falls.
His voice is gravelly, as if his throat is full of stones and his words leap over them.
Belton Falls is smack on the New Hampshire-Vermont line. Then the next stop, your last stop, right across the river, is Rutherburg, Vermont.
He consults the map again.
You're lucky, Skipper, he says. You're going to touch three states, Massachusetts, where you're standing right this minute, and then New Hampshire and Vermont. But you're traveling at an angle, and you only have to cover about 70 miles to do it.
70 miles doesn't seem far. Standing here in the gasoline station, anxious to be on my way, my legs itching to pedal that bike, 70 miles seems insignificant.
The old man looks up from the map.
How fast you figure you can go, Skipper?
I want to get away, but he's a nice old man. White hair and a face with so many red and blue veins that it resembles the road map in his hands. I had stopped at the service station to rest and ask for a map and to check the air in the tires. The old man, who seemed to be just hanging around, was eager to help, using a gauge to measure the air and then hunting up a map. I figure I can make 10 miles an hour, I say.
Lucky if you make 5 or even 4,
the old man says.
I don't think you're going to make it today, Skipper.
My mother and father and me, we once stayed in a great motel in Belton Falls. If I can make it that far, I can stay there tonight. The old man squints at the map again. It flutters in the breeze.
Well, maybe. But there's other motels before then.
He starts to fold the map.
Where are you from, Skipper?
Monument. It has turned cold now, and the sun has disappeared behind the clouds.
Let's see. This is Aswell. How long did it take you to make it here from Monument?
I really want to be going. About an hour. He strokes his chin with the map. The map bulges in his hand. He has done a terrible job of folding it.
Well, from downtown Monument to this very spot is about 5 miles. But you had some good hills to coast down. 5 miles an hour, probably the best time you'll do all day.
Yes. He turns away and looks up at the sky, and then back at me again.
What do you want to go for, Skipper? It's a terrible world out there. Murderers and assassins. Nobody's safe on the streets. And you don't even know who to trust anymore. Do you know who the bad guys are?
I want to be going. I don't want to listen.
Of course you don't. Because you can't tell the good guys from the bad guys anymore. Nobody knows these days. Nobody. No privacy either. Next time you use a phone, you listen. Listen close. You might hear a click. And if you do, then somebody's listening. Even if you don't hear a click, somebody might be listening anyway.
I kick at the tire of the bike.
Don't trust anybody, Skipper. Ask for identification if a stranger comes near you. But you can't trust identifications either. They can forge anything today. Passports, licenses, you name it. So if you have to go, Skipper, be careful. Be careful.
He hands me the road map.
Keep it, he says.
It's spotted with grease and not folded right, but I tuck it into the basket, sliding it between the strap and my father's package.
You're a sight for sore eyes, Skipper, he says. That cap you got on? I haven't seen one of them for years. In the old days, we called them toques. The wife used to make them for the kids, with cut-rate wool she picked up at the mill.
It's my father's cap, I say. He kept it all these years. I'm going to visit him. He's in a hospital in Rutterburg, and I figure he'll get a kick out of seeing the cap.
That your father's jacket, too?
He asks.
Looks like one of them army fatigue jackets. I had a boy in the service. World War II, that was. He wore a jacket like that. Looked too big for him, like yours. He got killed at a place called Iwo Jima, you probably never heard of.
The blue veins are bulging out on his face, all mixed up with the red ones. I want to leave. I'm getting nervous. I feel bad about his son, but I don't want to talk to him anymore. I'm afraid that he'll start asking about my father and my mother. I'm sorry about your son, I say. He doesn't say anything, but he wipes his hand across his face and sighs heavily, as if he is suddenly very tired.
Well, have a good trip, Skipper, he says, stroking the front tire. If I was 40 years younger, I'd go along with you. The spirit's willing, but the flesh is weak, like they say.
I leap on the bike. I head for the road. Thanks, I yell, looking back at him. Thanks for the map and the air and the tires. He stands there, looking sad, hands hanging at his sides.
Be careful now,
he calls, his voice cracked by the wind. I wave and turn away, pedaling hard. I have a destination to reach, and the old man is already in the past. I am away. I am with the wind and the sun. I am the bike, and the bike is me.
Tape OZK-002-1430. Date deleted, TA. Now tell me, should we discuss Paul Del Monte?
Who?
Paul Del Monte. 8-second interval.
I'd prefer not to.
5-second interval. Amy hurts, then?
My headache is returning.
Relax for a moment. I shall send for medication.
I'd rather not have medication right now.
As you wish. 10-second interval. You seem upset. Please relax. Realize that the tension and the headache are anxiety reactions, and I'm sorry you're reacting this way. When we undertook these talks, we agreed that they must be voluntary on your part, and that I would act merely as a guide. I would not take you to places where you do not wish to venture, into territory you do not wish to invade.
I understand.
We can return to Paul Del Monte and Amy Hertz another time.
My head really hurts. I feel nauseous, too.
Let us suspend, then.
Thank you.
End tape OZK-002.
The road is long and level and straight, and there are no dogs in sight, and the sun is shining. I sing as I pedal along. The farmer in the dell, the farmer in the dell, hi-ho the merry-o, the farmer in the dell. The cars speed past me, because Route 119 is a state highway, with a faded yellow line in the middle of it, like an old ribbon left out in the rain too long. I sometimes steer the bike onto the sand of the soft shoulder, afraid that a car might hit me if I stray too far into the road itself. The wheels slide on the sand, and I almost lose my balance. I keep singing. The farmer takes a wife, the farmer takes a wife, hi-ho the merry-o, the farmer takes a wife. I try to sing the song the way my father always sings it, comically, making his voice go up and down, then loud and soft. He has a terrible singing voice. You have a tin ear, my mother always says, but he gets a kick out of singing that particular song. It's our song, he says. I can remember how he'd pick me up when I was just a kid and swing me almost to the ceiling singing, the wife takes the child, the wife takes the child. And then he'd gently place me in my mother's lap, where she'd be sitting, knitting or reading, and I would curl into her body, feeling warm and safe and protected from all the bad things in the world. I was only 5 or 6 at the time, I guess. And my father sang raucously and joyously. Hi-ho the merry-o, the farmer in the dell. Dave, Dave, my mother would say, you're a nut, a real nut. There was laughter and tenderness in her voice, and the lilac of her perfume surrounded me. Hey, what other family has a theme song tailor-made for them? My father would say, acting the clown now, prancing around the room. The child takes the cat. The child takes the cat. They didn't make up the song for us, my mother would say, falling in with the old game that always delighted me. This was in the days before she became sad, of course. Who says they didn't make up the song for us? My father would ask. Looking down at me, he'd say, what's your name, boy? Pretending to be very serious now. Adam, I'd answer. Adam Farmer. Glad to be a part of the game, a part of them. Right, my father would say. Suppose our name was Smith. Did you ever hear anybody singing, Mr. Smith in the dell, Mr. Smith? Oh, David, my mother would say. And I'd laugh with delight, and my father would begin singing again the way I sing now on Route 119. Hi-ho the merry-o, the child takes the cat. The day is suddenly glorious, the October trees burning in the sun, colors rioting, hectic reds and browns. Sometimes the wind rises, startling a flock of birds into flight, sending the leaves tumbling through the air and onto the highway. I pass a long meadow where cows lounge lazily, chewing their cuds. I am glad that I didn't take the pills, and I sing. The cat takes the rat, the cat takes the rat. Hi-ho, the merry-o, the cat takes the rat. I try to keep singing like my father, but I've lost the touch. The wind catches at my throat, and I realize I have to conserve my breath. My lungs burn, and I figure I'd better stop singing for a while. My shoulders throb with pain, and my fingers ache where they grip the handlebars. A hill confronts me, sloping upward endlessly. I look behind me. Nothing. I get off the bike and stare at the hill. I start pushing the bike and walk along beside it. I don't like to walk that way because I feel vulnerable. And I have to go to the John now. I should have gone at that gas station back in Aswell. I could go into the woods, but I hesitate to stray from the road. Who knows what lurks in the woods? I am not only afraid of dogs, but all animals, plus snakes and spiders. They are not rational. So I need to stay on the road and keep moving. Keep moving even if I'm tired. I reach the top of the hill, and a beautiful vista is spread below me. A mile or so away, a cluster of buildings and a white church steeple stabbing the sky. And I leap onto my bike again and start down the hill. Down, down, seeking again my old friend momentum. And the bike gathers speed and I am sailing now, sailing sweetly. And I am dashing toward that church steeple, heading toward it so swiftly that it seems I could become impaled on it if I lose control of the bike. I am slanting down the hill, and the wind eats at my cheeks, biting chunks out of my flesh, and I begin to sing again, trying to sound like my father and failing, but singing just the same. The farmer in the dell, the farmer in the dell. The wind takes my voice and scatters it in the air, and it disappears like smoke. I hit the straightaway. I am hurtling now, really zooming, and the trees and the telephones flash by. Hi-ho, the merry-o, the farmer in the dell. My voice breaks loud and clear against the wind, and I breeze on, feeling at last that I am really and truly on the way to Rutherburg, Vermont.
Tape OZK-003-0845, date deleted, TA. Shall we continue? 8 second interval. Do you feel well? 5 second interval. You seem unhappy, distracted. Is there anything wrong? 15 second interval. Have you been administered your medicine today? 10 second interval.
He had stepped outside himself, departed, gone from this place, and was outside looking in, watching himself and the doctor, if he was a doctor. He could be a doctor. He had a kindly face, although sometimes his eyes were strange. The eyes stared at him occasionally as if the doctor, if that's what he was, were looking down the barrel of a gun, taking aim at him. He felt like a target. That's why he was glad he could stand aside like this, step out of himself, and look back and see the two of them there in the room. He was curious about himself, of course, but he really didn't want to look at himself, and so he kept his eyes directed at his questioner, obliterating himself from the view. He hadn't realized he could be so clever, so cunning. And he thought, if I can step outside myself like this, maybe I can go to other places. The possibility delighted him, made him forget. Forget what? He wasn't sure. Something just hovering at the edge of his mind, scurrying away when he tried to capture it.
Perhaps we should postpone. 5-second interval. There's no hurry. We shall try again later. End tape OZK-003.
The dog is ferocious, and I am terrified. He is waiting for me at the end of a long, flat stretch at the bottom of the hill. I had seen him waiting for a long distance, when he was only a small, silent lump at the side of the road. Then, as I drew nearer, he revealed himself as a German shepherd, sleek and black, a silent sentinel guarding the driveway of a big white house. The house is set back from the road. I sense that the house is deserted, that I am alone out here with the dog. I pump furiously, wanting to sail by the dog as fast as possible, so fast that I will dazzle him with my speed and leave him stunned by my passing. The dog lifts his head at my approach, alert, ears sharp, as if he is accepting a challenge. My eyes swing quickly left to right and back again, but there are no rescuers in sight. The driveway behind the dog is empty, no cars in sight, and the house itself wears an abandoned look, as if the people have all gone away. Across the street, an open field lies behind a wandering low stone wall. As I approach, the dog steps out into the road, and I think, it's as if he has been waiting for me all my life. The dog is unmoving, his tail not wagging, his eyes like marbles. He is silent, watchful, a killer dog. I'm close enough now to see how his sleek hair is shiny, and I tell myself, let's go, it's just a dog. A dog is man's best friend. It's not a lion or a tiger. The dog makes a move, steps into the roadway directly in the path of the bike, his head lifted now, a snarl on his lips. He's silent. He hasn't barked or growled. Or maybe I can't hear the growl as the wind rushes past my ears. I pedal hard, crouched on the bike, fingers clutching the handlebars, legs pumping away, the bike aimed directly for him, afraid that if I try to steer around him, I will somehow lose my balance and be flung to the pavement, at his mercy on the pavement. I slit my eyes, and my legs slash away, and I hurtle toward the dog. And at the last possible moment, the dog darts aside, and now I hear his growl, and then the growl erupts into short, sharp, savage barks, and this is worst of all, because the barks reveal his teeth. The dog keeps trying to dash in front of the bike, as if he is more interested in stopping the bike than in attacking me. I take heart at this. The dog bites the front tire and turns away as the tire scrapes his nose and the wheel wobbles frantically. And I keep yelling to myself, "It's all right! It's all right!" But my words are lost on the wind, and inside I am saying, "The hell with this. If I get away from this dog, I'm going home. I'm taking the first bus back. The hell with Rutterburg, Vermont. The hell with everything." The bike is in danger of toppling now, as the dog continues to attack the front wheel. And I realize with horror that this has been its intention from the beginning. To topple the bike, send it askew, and have me crashing to the roadway, his victim. We are past the driveway now, and approaching a curve. I hope desperately that there is safety around the curve, a house or a store or a shack or anything. That's when I hear a car approaching, and a horn frantically blowing. I suddenly realize that I have drifted perilously close to the center of the road. The oncoming car, a yellow Volkswagen with luggage lashed to the roof, has to cut speed and swerve to avoid hitting me, the blast of the horn joined by the squeal of brakes. The dog is distracted by the car and the honking and the screeching, and it hesitates for a moment, pausing almost in midair, looking at the car as if puzzled or tempted. I keep pedaling, but I can't resist looking behind me, and I see the dog streaking away down the road in pursuit of the VW, barking wildly, body arched and stretched, a fuzzy, furry arrow. "Let's get out of here!" I yell to nobody, and renew my peddling, fear and panic having obliterated any weariness, any aching muscles. The barking of the dog grows distant as I swoop around the curve and sail steadily onward. I am approaching the main street of Fairfield, and it is hardly a main street and hardly a town, just a few stores and that church with the white steeple, and I speed through the street, carried by my momentum. I know I should stop, but I don't want to get off the bike. I want to keep going, to get to Rutterburg. I have a feeling that the dog will pursue me forever, will wait for me outside stores if I stop to eat or go to the John. I open my mouth and gulp air, and the rush of air is sweet in my lungs, and I feel strong again as the air caresses my lungs. I pedal through the town, across a wooden bridge, the sound of the slats like applause in my ears. And I say hello and goodbye to Fairfield and continue on my way, feeling as though I will never stop. Never stop.
Tape OZK 004 0800, date deleted, TA.
Are you a doctor?
Why do you ask?
Well, I've taken it for granted that you're a doctor, a psychiatrist, maybe. That first session, you said your name is Brint, but you didn't say Dr. Brint. And this place seems to be a hospital, but is it?
I'm happy to see you taking an interest in your surroundings. For a long time, you didn't do so. But what makes you think this place may or may not be a hospital?
Well, it doesn't smell like one. You know, hospitals have a medicine smell, and high white beds. The doctors wear white coats. The nurses dress in white, too. But not here. This place is more like...
Like what?
I don't know. A private home. Not merely a home, but an estate. All the rooms and all these people. A private sanatorium, maybe?
Does this bother you?
I don't know. There are so many things I don't know.
Well, then, let's find them out, shall we? 5-second interval. Those clues, for instance.
What clues?
You mentioned something about clues earlier.
He was wary again, on guard, distrustful. Yet he had no reason to distrust Brint, even though he was a stranger. Anyway, he was feeling much better, and he didn't even care if feeling better was only an illusion. Maybe he should tell Brint some of the clues. Not all, but some. He could do it because he felt good, in command. He could parcel out information, as if he were dealing cards, a little at a time. But he would have to be clever. Cunning.
Maybe the dog is a clue.
The dog?
Yes, the dog. I thought of the dog when I looked out the window this morning and saw a dog on the grass.
You mean Silver?
Is that his name? Silver? A German Shepherd?
Yes, a good dog.
I hate dogs.
All dogs?
Most of them.
Why is that? 10-second interval. You said the dog is a clue. You mean Silver or some other dog?
Some other dog.
Tell me.
The dog wasn't big, but it made up for its lack of size by its ugliness, the intensity of its eyes, and the way it stood there, implacable, blocking their path. There was something threatening about the dog, a sense that the rules didn't apply, like encountering a crazy person and realizing that anything could happen, anything was possible. "What kind of dog is that?" the boy asked, whispering. "I don't know, Adam," his father said. "I don't know much about dogs." "What do we do, Dad?" We bluff. The boy looked up at his father in wonder and disbelief. Suddenly, this man didn't seem like his father. His father was an insurance agent who went to the office every day and changed his car every 2 years and belonged to the Rotary Club. He wore horn-rimmed glasses and had a mustache. Not a shaggy mustache like the ones people wore who also had long hair, but a neat, trimmed mustache with glints of gray. Adam had always been aware of his father as a father, reading the newspaper, watching baseball and football on television, rooting for the Red Sox and cursing the Patriots, bringing work home from the office at night, reading the newspaper, kissing him goodnight with a peck on the forehead. A father. Like a cutout figure whose caption said father. The only time his father emerged as a person was when the subject of books came up. His father's eyes would shine, and he'd shake his head with wonder as he discussed this writer or that writer, writers like Hemingway and Fitzgerald, and a lot of others who stirred no recognition in Adam when he was a child. Wait until you get older, Adam. There are so many great books to be read. His father often could be found reading late into the night, slumped in his chair, the glasses perched on his long, thin nose, lost in the pages of a book, a sudden stranger in the house. Now his father seemed like a stranger again, as they stood in the woods, confronting the dog. He and his father weren't the kind of people who ordinarily strolled through the woods. City pavement was more natural under their shoes than grass or woodland paths. "Give me Mother Nature working nervously in neon," his father once said, "instead of turning the leaves all kinds of colors in the fall." Then what were they doing here in the first place? In the woods, at least a mile from nowhere? Adam wasn't sure. Actually, they had been heading for the library, a mid-afternoon stroll on a wind-tossed March Saturday. Adam loved to walk along with his father, trying to match his 9-year-old stride to his father's loping legs. They'd walk along, and his father would have to slow down once in a while so that he wouldn't get too far ahead. His father loved the library, a treasure house, he called it. All those books, all those records. Today, he said, they'd look for Louis Armstrong records and bring them home. Great stuff that Adam would also love. A marvelous old record called 12th Street Rag, in which Louis Armstrong made his trumpet sound like a man staggering drunk along the street. Ah, that Armstrong. His father could do that, arouse Adam's interest by making him curious. How could a trumpet possibly sound like a man staggering along a street? Or he'd say, "I'll show you a mystery novel in which the first two letters of the first word of the first chapter hold the secret to the book." When, Dad? When? Anyway, they were on their way to the library for the Armstrong record, bending against the dancing wind, when suddenly his father stopped in his tracks, and Adam, who had been holding his hand, was thrown off balance and almost fell. He looked up at his father, puzzled. His father stood there like a statue in the park, or as if stricken by some terrible disease that had paralyzed him. "Let's go," his father said, finally snapping into action. He tugged at Adam's arm. He almost dragged him around the corner and through a narrow alley between Baker's drugstore and Admadio's furniture. "Hey, Dad," Adam cried, "where are we going? The library's not this way."
"I know, I know," his father said, plunging into one of his imitations, this time W.C. Fields, an old-time movie comedian who talked out of the side of his mouth, giving forth fancy and ridiculous words, as his father was now doing. "Let us stalk other landscapes as we ponder the wonders of the third month of the year, my boy." His voice nasal, and his fingers flicking the ash from an invisible cigar as he hurried along, pulling Adam with him. Adam looked behind. They seemed to be running away. But from whom? From what?
"Ah, the woods," his father said,
still W.C. Fields, as he indicated the beginning of a section of trees and brush that ran for a mile or so toward the state highway. As they entered the wooded area, he saw his father glance backward. Adam followed the glance, Still, nobody there.
"Everything all right, Dad?"
he asked, lips trembling. "Just fine, Adam, just fine," his father said in his own voice. So they plunged into the woods, tripping sometimes over tree limbs knocked down during winter storms, crashing through brush as if they were on safari in Africa, and after a while, Adam began to enjoy himself.
"Hey, Dad, this is kind of fun,"
Adam said. His father, breathing hard, tousled Adam's hair. "Not as bad as I thought it would be," he said. Adam felt a sense of camaraderie. And that was when they encountered the dog, like an apparition from nowhere. Ugly, unidentifiable, a pig-like snout, glittering eyes and yellowed teeth. "This is ridiculous," his father said now. Adam knew what his father meant by ridiculous. Here they were being frightened and intimidated and held at bay by, of all things, a dog. Not an armed robber, not a wild animal, but a dog. Adam felt, in fact, that he and his father might have been running away from a greater danger behind them. But that danger evaporated in the presence of the dog. The dog looked capable of attack and violence, the low growl in its throat menacing, deadly. "Let's back up a little," his father said. But the movement brought a loud growl from the animal. The boy's heart began to beat wildly. "Look, Adam, we've got to do something about this."
"But what, Dad?"
Adam asked, feeling his chin trembling. "First, I want you to get out of here."
"I want to stay with you, Dad."
"Look, the dog will probably let one of us go. Here's what to do. I'll take a small step forward. You take a big one backward. That might confuse him. Then take another one while I make a slight movement. But go slow. Don't upset the beast. Just walk backward. Keep going."
"Where will I go?"
"I heard traffic a while ago. The highway runs to our left." His father was talking softly, barely moving his lips. "Make it to the highway and flag down a car."
"But what about you, Dad?"
"I think I can handle it alone. I'll try moving back," he said.
"I want to stay with you, Dad."
Actually, he wanted to get away. He was terrified of the dog, but he felt as though he'd be betraying his father if he left. "You'll be helping most by going, Adam," his father said, finality in his voice. "Now, do it slowly." Adam retreated reluctantly, backing up slowly, not daring to glance at the dog, keeping his eyes on the ground, hoping he wouldn't trip and find himself on the ground, the dog rushing at him. He heard his father muttering, "A dog, for Christ's sakes." The dog didn't move. Adam glanced up. The dog's ferocious eyes were on his father. Adam took one more step, and the dog attacked, the growl reaching a siren's howl as the animal leaped toward his father. His father stepped aside, one arm outstretched, the dog's teeth ripping the sleeve of his father's jacket. The teeth caught on the jacket for a moment, long enough for his father to fling the animal away, changing its course for an instant. In that instant, his father cried for Adam to run, but Adam was frozen with horror to the spot. His father crouched low, close to the ground, meeting the dog at its level. But Adam saw that his father's right hand was searching the ground for a weapon, a stone or a stick. The dog, too, was crouched, body sloped forward, chin almost touching the ground. Adam's father slowly rose from the crouched position. He held a tree limb in his hand. The limb was about an inch thick. He thrust it toward the dog, as if offering the animal a gift. For the first time, the animal seemed confused, the glittering eyes wavering in their intensity. Then, without warning, the dog leaped again, but this time at the limb, grasping it with its teeth. His father grabbed the limb with both hands and swung it as the dog closed its jaws around it. He swung furiously, the dog hanging on frantically. Suddenly his father let go of the limb. allowed it to soar away from him, the dog still gripping it in its teeth. Thrown off balance and spinning dizzily in the air, the dog fell awkwardly to the ground, howling now, scurrying to its feet. Adam's father grabbed another branch, and another. He held tree limbs in each hand.